And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dodson. Since 2013, the National Hellenic Museum has presented a mock trial series that features some of the area's top attorneys, judges, and celebrity jurors to argue a case based in ancient Greek mythology or history in front of a live audience. In 2023, Socrates was retried on charges of impiety and corruption of the youth of Athens, but this trial resulted in a not guilty verdict. The philosopher from Athens is credited as the founder of Western philosophy. He was a Greek philosopher from 5th century BC, but we still use some of his teachings today. Socratic questioning is one example of how Socrates lives on. The year 399 BC, the city is Athens, troubled again by the political instability that saw the collapse of its maritime empire after nearly 30 years of war with Sparta. The form of government has changed twice in the last 4 years, from democracy to an oligarchy, of 30 tyrants, and back again to an uneasy democracy. The Trial of Socrates will make its broadcast premiere on Lakeshore PBS this Friday, May 10th at 9 p.m. Joining us now is the recently retired Honorable Judge Anna Demokopoulos, who served as one of the distinguished judges for the mock trial. Judge Demokopoulos, thank you so much for joining us today on Lakeshore Public Media.
Well, thank you for having us, Dee.
Absolutely. So, Judge Demokopoulos, I must say this. The trial of Socrates, the mock trial staged by the National Hellenic Museum, was absolutely phenomenal. It was engaging and enlightening. And as I was watching, my thought process was this. Of course, many of us in either high school and or college, we had to take a philosophy class or two, right? But to see this reenactment, it really helps you to understand Socrates' contributions to modern day democracy. Judge Demokopoulos, we are just so honored to have the opportunity to chat with you today. Your resume is quite impressive and extensive, as you have presided over several high-profile cases that are well-known in Greater Chicagoland. Before we dig deeper into the trial of Socrates, can you take a moment to tell your story to our listening audience, as well as what drives your passion for not only the law, but also for Grecian history?
So first of all, thank you, Dee, for having me on the show and for highlighting the trial of Socrates that the National Hellenic Museum puts forward. As you mentioned, I have been either an attorney or a judge for a little over 39 years now, and I think it's fair to say that I'm a very blessed woman, that every morning I would get up to go to work, whether when I was a prosecutor or a sitting judge, because I truly enjoyed the courtroom. It was a place that was intellectually challenging for me and emotionally satisfying both at the same time. And I think it's important that, you know, you have a career that replicates that, because we want to be happy in life, right? And so this was what made me happy. It's no secret, my last name, I'm Demokopoulos. I am a first generation Greek. My parents both immigrated to the States, my mom in 1951, my dad in 1956. I have four siblings, and we grew up in a very, very tight-knit Greek household and in the community. You know, our parents had a difficult time assimilating into the American culture, and so they wanted to make sure that their children did, but we still retained our Greek heritage, our Greek culture, and our Greek tradition. So those things are, you know, two things that are very, very important to me and actually define who I really am. A Greek woman who's also challenged and continuously looks for that intellectual challenge. So when the National Hellenic Museum 2013 started their first trial series, the first time that we tried Socrates, it was a perfect match for me. It was the ability to blend both my love for the courtroom and the love for my Greek heritage together. And so it has been a great 11-year run with the trial series through the National Hellenic Museum.
Great. Now, again, you're with us today to discuss the program, The Trial of Socrates, the mock trial that gives an authoritative account of Athens, Greece, over 2,500 years ago. On trial is a 70-year-old Greek citizen, loved by many and hated by just as many. A man who lived in poverty, but spent his life in conversation with others, most often with the city's youth, seeking with them the truth and trying to help them to find what a life worth living might look like. Socrates is known as the godfather of philosophy. The formal charges against Socrates were impiety and corruption of the youth of Athens. And I must say this, the attorneys that took part in the trial of Socrates for both the prosecution as well as the defense did a wonderful job of presenting their cases, applying the laws from that time period. How did this event come together?
So as I indicated, the trial series through the National Hellenic Museum began in 2013, and it was exactly for the reasons that we stated, that the museum's mission is to share Greek history, culture, and tradition, and the Greek American story. And so the museum thought that this was a great way because many of the controversies that were happening in ancient Greece, and that was the birthplace of democracy, and whether or not democracy was a form of government that really was successful, is the same challenges that we see today. And so we try to replicate controversies that happened in ancient Greece or in mythology, whether it be science or medicine or philosophy, and we replicate those trials. So in the trial of Socrates, he was tried for impiety, and that is that he was defying the gods, as well as corrupting the youth. And as you said, most of us have taken those philosophy courses and have learned that, you know, Socrates was a great philosopher. What we have discovered, or at least what is really kind of unknown, is that Socrates never really wrote anything. Zero. It was his students and his pupils that actually did his writings and replicated, or at least repeated, his teachings. And his biggest, what we in law school have all learned, is the Socratic method of teaching. And that is questioning everything. Make sure that as a young adult, you question everything. Don't just take something for granted. And so Socrates was actually tried, however, for corrupting the youth, because it was actually his students, the 30 tyrants, who actually were responsible for attempting to overthrow the democracy of Athens. Because remember, Athens was different than any of the other city-states. Their democracy was very different. It was a true democracy of the people. And so he's actually tried for corrupting the youth. And what's very unique about the program is last year in 2023, when we did the trial of Socrates, it was actually a retrial because we tried him the first time in 2013. And in 2013, he was actually found guilty by the audience as well as the judges and the celebrity jury. In 2023, it was the complete opposite. He was found not guilty. And so the trial series actually demonstrates the beauty of the courtroom, right? Who is the real trier of the facts? Who is the real person who decides guilt or innocence? And that's the jury. And so there's so many different facets to this trial. And like you said, the lawyering is exceptional. It really is exceptional.
Lakeshore Public Media will premiere The Trial of Socrates on Lakeshore PBS this Friday, May 10th at 9 p.m. As you shared, Socrates was retried on charges of breaking Athenian laws when he was found guilty and put to death at the age of 70 in ancient Greece. Now, The Trial of Socrates, which was a live-to-tape program, was filmed in 2023 at the National Hellenic Museum. As you've already shared, is an annual mock trial series that features some of the area's top attorneys, judges, and celebrity jurors to argue a case based in ancient Greek mythology or history in front of a live audience. This crowd was packed. I mean, this was a crowd of 500 people. And so I have to ask you, Judge Dimakopoulos, why do you believe so many are just fascinated with mock trials, with reenactments, like the trial of Socrates?
Oh, it's really no secret, Dee. We're all courtroom junkies, right? I mean, Whether you're watching it on television, you're watching it in the theater, you're at the courthouse, it's just drama. And it's human nature. Like, we all love to watch the interaction between human beings and trying the controversy. So I think that that's why the trial series is successful is, one, it appeals to everybody. We're all courtroom junkies, number one. Number two, the quality of the lawyering. Right. If you were to go to the courthouse and watch, you know, Tinos Diamandatos from Morgan Lewis or Pat Collins or Bob Clifford or Dan Webb, you know, the line would be out the door just so that you can watch them because they are so talented in presenting their case. They're passionate about what they present and they present their case in such a way that it's entertaining. So when you take those two things in combination with the ability to actually have a thought-provoking topic, right? He's charged with corrupting the youth. And here we are today, and you have all this news about how, you know, social media may be doing that, advertisers may be doing that, newspapers may be doing that, or, you know, fake news, excuse me. So, you know, it's a topic that's very relevant and continues to be relevant.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you brought that up because I was a little afraid to ask you this, but now I'm going to ask you because we were speaking about, obviously, the trial of Socrates over 2,500 years ago, but I'm also looking at what's happening on college campuses across the United States right now, even close to home at both Northwestern University and the University of Chicago. And I'm looking at that, and I'm also looking at, as you just alluded to, the power of social media, right? How within minutes, how things can be just shared on social media. And I had a thought. I wondered if this was 2,500 years ago, I would only assume that those college students that are actively participating in democracy, exercising First Amendment rights, a freedom of speech, I feel like they would suffer the same fate of Socrates.
So that's a great analogy and a great opportunity to show why the trial series is so relevant, right? What was happening in the Agora in ancient Athens, where the youth were actually very vocal about their criticism of true democracy, we now have the youth in America who are actually exercising their right to free speech. So you look at the two comparisons, nothing has changed. We still have a situation where some people believe that they are exceeding their right to free speech. We have some people that are accusing that, oh, these children or these young adults may have been brainwashed or something of that nature. So the controversy, it's the same controversy over and over again that we continue to see and to hear. And so I think it's great that our youth are getting involved, right? There's nothing wrong with our youth being able to express their freedom of speech. The question becomes, when do you exceed and you balance the freedom of speech, the right to demonstrate, with infringing on somebody else's right? And so those are exactly the same thing that Socrates was tried on. One time he was found guilty, the next time he was found not guilty. It's really a question for the jurors to decide, which is another reason why the trial series is so unique. Unlike what we normally see on television or in reality, where a judge is actually deciding it or a jury of 12, in ancient Athens, guess how many jurors comprised of a criminal jury? Guess how many jurors were actually picked?
I don't know. I would assume it would be a small number of select few citizens.
It was actually, if it was a criminal trial, it was more than 500.
Wow.
And here's the reason why. They thought, well, it's really unlikely that you can corrupt or bribe 500 people. So this way, it was an opportunity for them to have a jury that was not likely to be corrupted. So 500 Athenians would come into the arena and watch the trial, and they would decide, and they would vote, guilty or not guilty. And so when we replicate that, at the National Hellenic Museum trial, the only verdict that really counts is the audience. And so we have, you know, sometimes we've had as many as 1,000 people that have come to watch the trial. It's their decision. It's their decision that actually counts. That's the actual decision. It's not the judges, and it's not what we call our celebrity jury, which is usually members of the media, some politicians, some members of academia, as well as some lawyers. So it's the jury. It's the audience. It's the everyday folks. That's whose decision really counts.
Wow. And now I understand. Now I can fully understand why, despite the fact that you had an esteemed panel of jurors in attendance, as well as three other justices that were on the bench with you who each rendered a verdict, that ultimately the decision of the fate of Socrates was decided upon by the 500 attendees of this program.
Correct. But when you ask people that have come to multiple trials in Washoe, why do you keep on coming? Why do you participate in this? And for them, it is an opportunity for thought-provoking and engaging conversation, right? It's not only entertaining, but you literally, particularly when, you know, sitting on the bench and watching the audience, and you'll see the prosecution put their case on, and you'll see people nodding their heads and, you know, agreeing with them. And then you see the other side get up, and you can literally see the thought-provoking process happening within the audience. And so that's something that I think is missing so much in our society these days, that people read it, they don't interact with each other, everything is instant gratification, you know, they read it and that's the end of it. There's no conversation, where here you actually see the opportunity for people to engage with one another. And then when you take the break and they're collecting the chips and you can see everybody congregating and talking and discussing it, it's really cool to watch. And then afterwards at the after party, you can, you know, people to this day, people are still talking about it, right? So it's kind of a cool process.
It absolutely is, Judge Demacopoulos. And I must say, as soon as I watched in its entirety the trial of Socrates, I went straight to the National Hellenic Museum website to find out when the next one is, the next mock trial in this mock trial series. And I'm sad to report that I just missed it.
Yes, we do it every year. Actually, right. The last one was on April 17th. It was cool.
Is there a charge for tickets?
Yeah, so every year there is a charge for the tickets. The last couple of years it has been at the Harris Theater. It is a fundraising event for the museum, and so it goes into a good cause.
Judge Demacopoulos, I want to end our conversation with a quote from Socrates. So Socrates once said, in a quote, "Democracy thrives when its young citizens are informed and critical thinkers," end quote. And for me in that quote, the key word is informed. The Honorable Anna Demacopoulos is a retired circuit court judge of the Circuit Court of Cook County. Again, Judge Demacopoulos, thank you for spending time with us today on Lakeshore Public Media, and we look forward to the broadcast premiere of The Trial of Socrates, which will air on Lakeshore PBS this Friday, May 10th at 9 p.m.
My pleasure, and please watch The Trial of Socrates, and next year, The Trial of Pericles.
And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson. The Federal Open Market Committee kept the Fed funds rate unchanged in a range between 5.25% and 5.5% in its policy statement on Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. The FOMC maintained a loosening bias, but rate cuts do not appear imminent. The statement says, quote, "The committee does not expect it will be appropriate to reduce the target range until it has gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%, end quote. The statement noted an easing in inflation over the past year, but also that it remains elevated. Joining us now to give a local, statewide, and national outlook is Ersung Leong, an economist with the PNC Financial Services Group, Inc. Ersung, as always, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me again, Dee.
Absolutely. So it's been about a month since we last checked in with you, and so we always like to check in with PNC Financial Services Group to get an economic outlook. So the FOMC meeting was this week. So what are some key takeaways from the Fed's monetary policy decision?
So so at this week's FOMC meeting, so the decision was largely affected. The Federal Open Market Committee kept the Fed funds rate unchanged, and the FOMC meeting maintained a loosening bias, but rate cuts does not appear going to anytime soon. And the statement also provided an update on the process of the balance sheet reduction. So the so-called quantitative tightening. So the Fed let some of their long-term securities to mature and roll off their balance sheets, so that way to putting some upward pressure on the long-term interest rate. But starting in June, the Fed will less of their treasuries to roll off per month, down from about $60 billion currently. So that kind of slow the pace of QT and give the Fed more flexibility, in calibrating the optimal size. And in discussing the current economic outlook, the FOMC statement noted the solid economic growth, strong job growth we have been talking about, and near historic low unemployment rate that we pointed out earlier. So the result or this decision made at the FOMC meeting, this was largely as expected, and the committee will still want to see more easing in inflation before it starts to cut off the Fed funds rate. And it is holding off for now until it is sure that the reacceleration in inflation will reverse somewhat.
Now, can you give an update on the first jobs report that recently came out?
We talked in previous months that U.S. labor market was still very strong. And in April, we got this U.S. economy adding about 175,000 jobs. So this is somewhat below the recent pace and the smallest number of job gains added since November, but it is still solid. So over the past 3 months, the economy has added about average 242,000 jobs per month. So that is still above the economy's long-run potential. And I think that, with this pace, this is what the Federal Reserve Bank wants to see. With slower employment gain, the economy will start to cool off a bit. And in order to, help to the Fed's 2% inflation objective. And in this jobs report, the private sector added more jobs than the government sector. Well, the government only added about 8,000 jobs. And unemployment rate increased slightly to 3.9%. And the unemployment rate has now been below 4% for 27 straight months. And the longest such stretch since the late 1960s. Well, we were seeing strong job gains in private services providing industries, and goods producing industry only added 14,000 jobs. And the private service providing industry added about 153,000 jobs. And average hourly earnings were also easing. So that is the good news for the Federal Reserve, which remains concerned about wage growth that's running too hot to achieve the central bank's 2% inflation objective. So overall, the April jobs report was close to what the Federal Open Market Committee wants to see. And this jobs report is also consistent with the FOMC cutting the Fed funds rate to a couple times later this year. And the market reaction was also positive.
Now, before I let you go, Arshang, so we're in the second month of the second quarter of the year. So I have to ask you before you go, is there any update on PNC's economic outlook since the end of the first quarter?
Yes, Dee. So the major change was that PNC has changed its near-term outlook for the Fed funds rate. So remember last time we were forecasting the Fed funds rate that there will be 325 basis point cuts in Fed funds rate this year. Well, PNC has reduced the number of rate cuts for several reasons. So consumer price index inflation came in stronger in the first quarter. The prices were up 3.5% in March from a year earlier. So that is an acceleration from 3.2% inflation in February. And core inflation, core CPI, so total inflation excluding the volatile food and energy, that part was up 3.8% year over year. So at the same pace as in February, so really wasn't easy. So inflation turned out to be more sticky than we thought. And inflation slowed dramatically from mid-2022 to late last year, but the pace of improvement has essentially stopped over the past few months. So besides that, inflation turns out to be more sticky. The U.S. labor market remains very strong, with job growth of 300,000 in March and average hourly earnings easing at the same time. So given the acceleration in inflation in recent months, PNC has changed its near-term outlook for the Fed funds rate. And in its April baseline forecast, PNC now has two Fed funds rate cut of 25 basis points each. So one will be at FOMC's July meeting. Another one will be at the November meeting.
Ersheng Leung is an economist with the PNC Financial Services Group. Ersheng, as always, we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, giving a local, statewide, and national economic outlook. And we look forward to having you back with us next month.
Thank you, Dee. Thanks for having me.
And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. Kelly Carey's passion for animals led her to establish Silver Stray in 2019. Since its inception, the 501c3 nonprofit organization has assisted more than 700 Gary pet families. Silver Stray is the silver lining for Gary's pets before they wind up on the street, sick, or in an overwhelmed shelter. The organization uses the visibility of their highly trafficked monthly clinics to provide a bridge to vital resources that help create a culture of sharing and build a stronger community. Joining me now to talk about the great work her organization is doing to assist pet families in the region is Kelly Carey, the founder of the organization. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Kelly, I want to know your story. So, what is the story that led you to form the organization Silver Stray?
So, I used to work at a shelter where I would find that marketing and social media was always kind of on the lower of the priorities. And so that would always lead to the seniors and special needs animals to kind of, they would not be adopted as quickly as they could, you know, without utilizing proper social media and marketing presence. And so I had a knack for that, and I was really good at it. And I had this affinity for this one dog that was in the shelter for 3 years. Her name was Layla, and no fault of her own. She just kept being returned, and she sat, and she was a senior, and it really bothered me. So I took to local platforms where, you know, the paper, the radio stations, flyers, anything that you can think of, we did. And so to no avail, it didn't work. We received a really high traction, but still we just were not able to find her home. So then I thought bigger, and I moved to larger platforms, like national platforms. And eventually BarkBox picked up her story, and her story ended up being on Google, like just the morning page, you know, the page when you click on the Google search engine, her story was right there. A family in Silver Spring, Maryland does their daily scroll on Google. Her name is Lilia Wagner. She opened Google, and there's Layla's story. And long story short, they contacted the shelter. They wanted to adopt Layla. They live out 11 hours away. They after getting all the logistics straightened out, they finally made the journey a couple months later to adopt Layla. And so then 6 months later, for my birthday, we decided to go and visit Layla and John and Lilia. And then the rest is history. Like, now I'm part of the family. You know, they're older now. So I go every month or every 2 months to visit them, to help them. You know, they don't have any children of their own. I mean, I'm in their will. I mean, it's just like how strangers turned into family all because of a dog. And not every situation is going to happen like this, you know, or end up have a conclusion like this, but it's just such an amazing story. And so after Layla, that's how I created Silver Stray, because I said, you know, I was like, this can't, you know, this happens everywhere. You know, there's shelter everywhere in shelters. There's animals that are sitting, or, you know, and because shelter workers, you know, they're not, maybe they don't have the know-how, or they're not paid enough, or they have to take care of 40 other animals, and they don't, you know, Facebook and social media is the last thing on the docket. So, or in the last, the last priorities to above care. And so I created Silver Stray, and then I helped some dogs in down south that were in shelters for 6 years, and another one for three years. And then I took a break, and I got my big girl job, my career after going to school and everything. I became an ecologist, and which landed me working a lot in Gary and restoring one of the last highest quality dune and swales in Northwest Indiana left is in Gary. So I worked there for many, many years and still working on the back burner, very in a small amount, like even on the weekends at shelters. So I kind of never left the animal welfare field. But and then eventually I just decided that animal welfare was more of a passion. And I started working in another local shelter, and I had a lot of families from Gary come in that needed assistance, and I couldn't help them because they were not in our jurisdiction at the time. So, and that bothered me. So I left, and I had already had the nonprofit established for logistics, you know, and so I left the shelter, and I just decided, you know what, I know what I'm capable of. I'm going to do it. I left and I started the program. You know, I was already familiar definitely with the community and the landscape of Gary. So this wasn't just like I was coming in blind. And now it's just, it is flourishing. We are helping so many people. So much good is being done. And I really, this isn't just like another, you know, it's just not another rescue in town. This is really, mm-hmm. I feel like through all my mileage in animal welfare, I really have come to the solution of how to really stabilize and heal a pet community. And obviously, you know, unless you live under a rock, you know how underserved Gary is. And so, and they, you know, there's not really anybody, any organization in Gary to provide the help that we can or that we do. And so here we are talking to each other about the program.
Right, absolutely.
Sorry that was like a story not so short, but it's not really a short story.
No. And I love that you shared that, because I was actually going to ask you, you know, you spoke about your volunteerism with the shelter and your work with the shelter, as well as your work in restoration ecology in Gary. And so I was going to ask you, is that what inspired you to help local families? Because let's be real, being a pet family is quite expensive. You look at the income levels of, let's just compare families in Porter County, in Valparaiso, for instance, to families in Gary, Lake County in Gary, and they are not equal. And so I was going to ask you, is that what led you, your work seeing animals during your professional work in restoration ecology, is that what led you to help families in the city of Gary?
I mean, so while I was doing work, I was always doing like smaller things, like whether it was like on a much smaller scope, like or scale, like I would maybe porch drop food, or I would help like little spay and neuter, like little like families with, you know, out of my own pocket, even whatever. I just, you know, would come across a family that needed some help. And so I would help them. So I don't think it was really related to the ecology itself. I think it just was always like innately there. And then, for the longest time, I was really scared to start it, you know, and I didn't want to. And Jay, who's here, he always wanted me to. And I think it just had to, I had to figure it out for myself. I just actually had to pull the trigger and just do it. And so, but yeah, I think it was just always kind of there in me. And then I really realized that, you know, what the real solution is. And what it, you know, what it was. And it wasn't just this or that. It was really tackling the parts that we do of the program to really help families survive, not only survive, but really thrive.
So Kelly, earlier you mentioned one of the first pets that you helped was Layla. And so I just have to ask you, is Layla the inspiration behind the name of the organization?
Silver, obviously, like silver, like, you know, older, like the color silver gray, and then Stray, just because of the, you know, the stray animal. And then the shadow of the dog was my dog, Inky. She was a senior. And so Layla's the inspiration. Without Layla, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. So, but just not necessarily the logo or whatever. But yeah, she's the inspiration behind everything, everything. So any good thing that happens, it's all because of her, because without her, and the whole experience, this program would not exist.
Now I want to talk about the program. So Silver Stray hosts monthly clinics that offer free spay and neuter, free vaccines and microchipping, just to name a few of the offerings. Are the clinics for Gary residents only?
Yeah. So you just have to be a Gary resident. There's like drive-through clinics. It's like you're going to go through like a fast food place, right? And so a restaurant, and we have everybody stay in their cars. They advance in lines. Everybody stays in their cars for, you know, safety purposes. We have amazing volunteers, vet techs, really knowledgeable people that provide the services right in the car or right by the car. And then they receive proof of everything. And then on they go. We try to be efficient. You know, I joke, but we really, at this point, are pretty efficient, almost like Portillo's drive-thru. So,
right.
So we, and you know how efficient they are. And so, right. so we provide the free rabies vaccines, a free distemper vaccines, microchips. We don't have a dedicated pet food pantry, but we have really strong support through the community from pet food stores. So we always usually have supplies or some food, a little something to give away to everybody. And then free nail trims. We have people that are donating their time and skill for free nail trimming too, which is a really vital grooming task, you know, that sometimes definitely lacks, you know, that when the last thing to be done.
So, Kelly, you know, I was so excited to talk to you, obviously, because of the wonderful work that you're doing in the region. But I also wanted to share with you, meant to share this with you offline, but it's fitting that I share this with you during our conversation today. So my youngest girls are twins, and one of them has a heart that is just as big as yours. She always seems to attract stray kittens. And I must say, every time I see that look in her eyes of a kitten possibly going without being hungry, I'm not going to lie, I immediately run to the store, buy food. I've even purchased 2 outdoor cat houses as well to help keep them warm.
Sucked in.
Yeah, I get sucked in. With the weather changing, my husband said, there are 2 kittens in particular that just have made themselves at home. With the weather changing, my husband said to me, you know, it would be cruel if we left them outside. And so I said, oh boy, we brought them in, we got them checked out, ensured that they were, you know, in our home, we feed them and everything, but we discovered that one is expecting.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, boy. And the reason that I bring this up is because another thing that you guys offer is something that I've actually never heard of. It's called TNR, or Trap, Neuter, Return.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important because of the mating season. So explain to our listening audience what that means, especially for helping to control the pet population.
Yeah, Trap, Neuter, Release. It's basically, you know, there's a lot of community cat caretakers, and they, you know, we get calls for they feed 5 cats or 35 cats. You know, no number at this point is alarming to me. And they're doing the best they can. They just need help, right? And they multiply super quick. And it's, you know, springtime is mating time, and let's rock and roll for all the animals. So, but no, it's just basically, you know, you set a trap. It's like a raccoon trap. You can get anywhere, and you trap the cat. You obviously, it's always good to have an appointment ahead of the trapping, because you know you can't leave a cat in a trap. But you do it the night before, and then we have the appointment, and we take them, we transport them, and everything. But it really prevents disease. You know, they get vaccinated. They're vaccinated. They're flea treated. They're ear tipped, which is important because it's an identifying thing that tells you that it's a cat that has been fit. It's fixed. Basically, it's a signal that, or a sign that says, hi, I'm fixed. I'm taken care of. Leave me alone. And so if any cat with an ear tip ever comes into a shelter or anywhere, they're just going to say, you know what, this cat's been taken care of. Put it back where you found it. You know, that we know that it's fixed. This is a sign that it's fixed. And it really, you know, it really provides better community health, you know, and prevents disease, and just creates, you don't have to love cats to just want to do, you know, to, right. to be able to do the right thing, or just what's, you know, good. And so, yeah, it's important. TNR is important. I'm not even really that much of a cat person, but I know how important TNR is, you know, for the community, for community health and peace of mind for the caretakers. You know, they love these cats. They take care of them every single day, and they just want what's best for them too. So, it is really an important part of it. Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Full transparency, I am not a cat person at all either. But I have grown to admire those precious little kittens because, as you said, you do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. So
yeah, you can be like, you can hate them, but you just got to do the right thing. And it's not their fault. You know, like we're the ones the humans' problem that we're not fixing them and, you know, controlling the population. So it's not their fault.
Now, Kelly, I have to ask you, how do you do it all? I mean, being able to serve as a resource to help pet families is quite costly. And you alluded to earlier some of the organizations that you work with, including pet stores, but do you have a lot of community partners?
Yeah, I mean, so this is a major, there's 2 parts to this that I'd like to answer. One is I am like on the computer, like an FBI agent, creeping all day long, sending emails, 400 emails a day, calling people, Like, I don't sleep. I just wake up and start typey-typey. I just reach out to everybody and everybody. And you know, having the long mileage in animal welfare, I do have a lot of connections already and resources, which I'm so grateful for. But I'm just constantly always reaching out to more people to see how we can partner, you know, for more grant opportunities. And so people really, there's just so many yeses. You know, I always sometimes harp on the no's and I get so sad and then I'll start crying and just be so upset, but I can't focus on that. I have to focus on the yeses and all the, you know, the universe will just, you just have to be grateful. You just have to be grateful for everything. Mm-hmm. And then the universe just always provides and it just, it flows. It flows perfectly. So I just constantly am online all day calling and sending emails, trying to gain partners or find grants for the donations. And of course, social media awareness is huge too. You know, I post in Facebook groups and post online and have all the volunteers and everybody share. You never know the power of a share on social media. And so the community donations are huge. We really have a supportive community now behind that. But also the second super, super important part of the program is where I have tried to, or I am, gaining partnerships with local organizations that can provide families that with plugins to assistance with whether it be transportation, literacy, rent, homelessness, recovery, literacy, anything that you might need. There could be a plugin for a resource for this. And because I try to look at families as a whole, you know, I don't just care about the dog or cat. I care about the family as a whole, and you have to. And so, you know, a lot of these organizations in Northwest Indiana are underutilized, and they are there for people right in our backyard, but they don't know about them, right? So if I can promote the organization and what they provide anymore, or if I, you know, sometimes I can have them, I say, can you come to a clinic and pass out your literature? You know, we have a line sometimes of 100 to 200 cars that are just captive audience. They're just waiting in line. So you just go down that line, you talk to them about what you do, you pass out some tangible information. And we have the disability advocates from, Naraville, I think, that come out. And they walk the line, identifying families with disabilities, providing them help. And so they identify new families every single time who need assistance. And so, you know, anything from human food assistance to recovery assistance, I get phone calls all the time for different things. And so I try to put all the resources online, of course, on the website, or my phone number is like a public payphone at this point. So if you have some, you know, just call me and I can direct resources to you as well. So it's not just about providing TNR or, you know, a vaccine. It's really about providing that assistance for families as well, personally, that can help them. So that was kind of the two parts to your question.
No, that is awesome. And I think that I just got so excited at hearing you mention the plug-in to other resources for the entire family. It's not something that you hear a lot when you hear about animal help, animal rescue. And
right.
So I think
right.
that addition to the services that you provide is so awesome, honestly.
Because like with that, I really try to provide a culture of caring, you know, and I don't know the stats, but I know a lot more families are moving out than they're moving in. So maybe, you know, if we just create that template, you know, and maybe it will, they have like support now, you know, they have resources. They have resources for their NIPSCO bill, and I'll take care of your pet. And here's all these other resources. So maybe you don't feel like you have no other choice or there's no hope, you know, you're supported and here it all is, you know, so maybe they'll stay instead of moving out. So.
All right, Kelly, and before I let you go, you've shared a lot of information with us today, and I'm just so grateful that you took time out to join us. But for anyone who is interested in supporting your organization with their time, their talent, and or their resources, how can they get in contact with you?
They can call my phone number, 574-806-2810, or email info@silverstray.org, and all of that is on the website, silverstray.org. So they can definitely find everything that they should need on the website.
Kelly, I thank you so much for joining us today on Regionally Speaking, because you shared so much information about your organization, a lot of information that prior to me preparing for our conversation today, I was not aware of. So I thank you for carving out some time, spending time with us on Regionally Speaking today. And here's to hoping that you're able to help more pet families, but more importantly, that more resources are poured in into your organization.
Thank you so much for shedding light, because without time like this and opportunities like this, then, you know, I would not we would not be where we are.
Silver Stray views families with pets as holistic units, and their approach seeks to create a template for transformative change in Gary. By nurturing a culture of caring through Silver Stray, the organization is sowing the seeds for a compassionate community that encourages families to remain and not just survive, but thrive on a foundation of empathy. And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number was launched in September 2022. The number 988 aims to make it easier for people in crisis to connect with trained counselors. A vast majority of the calls will be resolved over the phone, but there will be people who need help in person. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett reports on how crisis services are often few and far between, but one solution might help fill this gap.
The first piece of this rollout is a place to call. So when people are having a mental health crisis, they can call 988 for immediate support. Next is someone to respond, which might look like mobile crisis teams. Finally, the third piece of this is a place to go. In other words, if someone is having a mental health crisis and needs in-person intervention, where will that be? In a lot of the U.S., that's in emergency departments or even jail. But throughout Illinois, there's nearly 24 facilities called living rooms. One of these is Unity Point Health's Unity Place in Peoria, Illinois.
There's kind of a home atmosphere. We've got recliners, large-scale TV, a Wii, a kind of a kitchen area that we have snacks and that kind of thing for guests that come in, a couple tables.
Christina Gerlach is the crisis services manager. She says these living rooms are meant to be a comfortable, welcoming place for people during a mental health crisis. People can just walk in, no doctor's note or payment needed. The ER is not an ideal place to receive mental health care. They're loud, sometimes chaotic. Staff don't always have mental health training. These living rooms are designed as an alternative, where people having suicidal or homicidal thoughts, panic attacks, severe depression, or struggling with substance use can easily find help. Living rooms are usually grant-funded, and Gerlach says they're primarily staffed with peer recovery counselors. This requires about a year of training and personal experience with mental health struggles or addiction.
We have absolutely had clients come in here who were definitely struggling and who came here and have said, this saved my life coming here, having this to be able to talk to somebody.
Earlier this year, 19-year-old Benjamin Kowalczyk had never heard of a living room. After a bad breakup, he says everything felt like it was crumbling around him.
And I had fallen into a bad depression state. You know, at that point, I realized, like, I need to get back into therapy and I need to do something about my mental health because it's declining very quickly.
Worried it would take too long to see his old therapist, Kowalczyk's mom was told about Threshold's Forever Hope, a living room in Chicago. So they went, spent about 30 minutes connecting with one of their counselors. In their follow-up meetings, they helped him find a therapist and psychiatrist.
And it was just such a enlightening experience going there for the first time. It made me feel like I actually had somewhere safe to go.
Now Kowalczyk says he's doing a lot better. Matthew Tassinari oversees the counselors at this same living room.
There's no better feeling for me to have someone come in and they're at the worst, you know, moment in their life. Sometimes they're in distress, they're crying. To have them leave with a smile on their face, to know that they have a safe place to come back to, it's truly amazing.
One of the downsides of living rooms in Illinois is they aren't open 24/7. But the benefit of these facilities is promising, even though the research on them is limited. In one small study, researchers found of the more than 200 visits to one living room outside Chicago, 93% of visitors didn't need further care at an ER, which saves money for both healthcare providers and patients. Michelle Haaland, an associate professor at Rush University in Chicago, led this study.
80% said the most helpful thing was the ability to talk through the situation and problem solve. 67 said the coping skills they worked on was the most helpful.
There are at least a dozen states that have similar models, including Arizona, Tennessee, and Colorado. In Illinois, leaders of living rooms aren't sure if the 988 rollout will mean a sudden influx of visitors, especially since it may take time for people to become familiar with the 988 hotline. In the meantime, they say they're carefully watching for any upticks. I'm Carter Barrett, Side Effects Public Media.
If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health or substance use crisis, you can call or text 988 from anywhere in Indiana 24/7. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guest, and we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.